This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
In tonight's lecture, in a series where it's rare to hear a good word spoken of anybody, it's the turn of that iconic figure of Irish nationalism, Constance Markievicz, to have dark doubts cast on her motives and her conduct. She was, of course, the first woman to be elected to the House of Commons, though as a Sinn Féin MP, she never took her seat and could well have been executed for her role in the Easter Rising. Picking apart her contribution to Irish history is journalist and historian Ruth Dudley Edwards, who's the author of a biography of someone who was not spared a firing squad in 1916, Patrick Pearse.
On a trip down memory lane in 1995 at the Rotunda, it was a Sinn Féin or the Esh, and Gerry Adams spoke about Constance Markievicz, a champion of the poor, a socialist, a feminist, a nationalist, and a Republican died. Permission for her lying in state in the City Hall or the Mansion House was refused by the state. Her remains were brought here to the Rotunda, where over 100,000 people filed by her coffin to pay their last respects. Gerry Adams Markievicz was the outlaw, the victim of the wicked Free State. The Markievicz of a government minister, Seamus Brennan, in April 2003, was a peace processor. Unveiling a statue to her in Sligo, he spoke of a woman of great vision who knew that when the fighting was over and the first steps to freedom won, that guns and weapons should be set aside and work should begin on constructing the political, economic and social framework within which Ireland could grow and prosper as an independent nation. Now, he explained, those involved in the peace process should follow Markievicz's example. In doing so, he said, they will be fulfilling the wishes of the Irish people, north and south, who voted resoundingly for a new beginning. There's just a few problems with this peace processing Markievicz. The Markievicz, of whom I'm speaking ill today, had absolutely nothing peaceable about her. She was a self-indulgent, bloodthirsty show-off, who brainwashed children into believing they must die for Ireland, who killed without pity, and who, defying the vote of the Irish people in June 1922 to accept the treaty, continued to murder during the Civil War. Craving excitement and the limelight, she adopted causes she barely understood because she was mesmerised by charismatic men. Although, and this is one good thing I have to say for her, she did give up a life of material comfort when she espoused revolution. Markievicz was a snob with a bogus title. She was physically brave, to the point of recklessness, but she lacked the moral courage to admit her failure of nerve when she was faced with the prospect of execution in 1916. She was beautiful, flamboyant, all style, no substance. Along with other uncompromising green harpies of her generation, my grandmother Bridget Dudley Edwards deserves a mention, Markievicz became a role model for generations of women who mistook pitilessness and intransigence for principle. The Protestant Constance Georgina, the athletic and bohemian daughter of Sir Henry Gore Booth of Lissadell in Sligo, was 30 when, at the turn of the century in Paris, she fell in love with a bohemian Catholic Polish widower, Kazimir Dunin Markievicz, who had some land in the Ukraine. She didn't want to incur the disapproval of her prosperous family, so she said he was a hereditary nobleman. Her brother Jocelyn asked the British ambassador to Russia to find out about his countenance. And the report was that he takes the title of Count Dunin Markievicz without right, in that Poland has never had a count of that name. He may have been able to buy this title in the Vatican or to obtain it in Austria. He hadn't, actually. His son by his first marriage, Stanislaus, left an envelope to be opened after his death, which read, "My father was not a count." So this great woman of the people, Constance, knew very well that she had no right to the title of Countess, but she used it. Now, her recent biographer, who thinks very well of her, says, given Constance's disregard for titles and snobbery, such concerns were of little interest to her. He quotes a letter she wrote her brother in 1911, after she had been busy trying to disrupt King George V's visit, in which she said, "Even if I were not a nationalist, I should object to kings' visits, for they but bring out the worst qualities in people. All sorts of snobbery is developed in people. Everyone using every means to get himself noticed." Pretty rich coming from her. So that was from the attention seeker, always known in Dublin as the Countess or Madame, which is how she even appears in the Doyle debates, Madame Markievicz. Now, she wasn't the only phony show-off. We must never forget Maud Gonne. There was a moment as I started to refresh my memory on Markievicz when I picked up Maud Gonne's A Servant of the Queen and I thought, why am I doing Markievicz? This one is worse. There's a wonderful reminiscence from prison of Tom Clark's widow, Kathleen Clark. Says, in the early days of our imprisonment, when we were out for exercise, Madame Markowitz and Madame McBride walked up and down the exercise yard together, discussing their mutual friends and acquaintances and disputing as to which of them had the highest social status. Madame Markowitz claimed that she was far above Madame McBride. She belonged to the inner circle of the Vice-Regal Lodge set, while Madame McBride was only on the fringe of it. I sometimes listened to them, quite amused. I was outside their social circle and had nothing in common with them socially. Madame Markowitz took pains to make me aware of the social gulf between us. It didn't worry me. But Maud. Oh, Maud. This is a servant of the Queen, her reminiscences, 1938. I was returning from Mayo triumphant. I should tell you, by the way, most of this is made up. I was returning from Mayo triumphant. I had stopped a famine and saved many lives by making the people... by making the people share my own belief that courage and will are unconquerable and, where allied to the mysterious forces of the land, can accomplish anything. Had I not seen death and despair recede? That afternoon at the wishing well in Ballinagh, where the girls of the town had led me while waiting for the train, I had seen the fish which they said none of our generation had seen. It had darted across the clear water, which bubbles up unceasingly at the foot of a green mound, where legend says a queen lies buried. I had wished the wish of all our hearts, a free republic, but had refused to tell, for it is unlucky to tell wishes. I had been seen off at the station by a cheering crowd and a band. The town council had presented me in a dress and a spinning wheel painted green and gold. Tired, but glowing. I looked out of the window of the train at the dark bogland where now only the tiny lakes gleamed in the fading light. Then I saw a tall, beautiful woman with dark hair blown on the wind, and I knew it was Kathleen Ni Houlihan. She was crossing the bog towards the hills, springing from stone to stone over the treacherous surface, and the little white stones shone, marking a path behind her, then faded into the darkness. I heard a voice say, "You are one of the little stones on which the feet of the Queen have rested on her way to freedom." The sadness of night took hold of me and I cried. It seemed so lonely just to be one of those little stones left behind on the path. Being old now and not triumphant, I know the blessedness of having been one of those little stones on the path to freedom. Now, I can't blame Maud and Constance for this Kathleen O'Houlihan rubbish. Men started all that dark Rosaline, Mother Ireland, Shan Van Vocht, Kathleen O'Houlihan stuff. Gone, as you know, was Yeats's Kathleen Ni Houlihan, 1902, I think it was, the play where she was the old woman seducing the boy who's about to be married to abandon all to retrieve her four green wheels. Sorry, fields. Well, she was one wheel short of a cart. And in this play she warned him, "It is a hard service they take that help me. Many that are red-cheeked will be pale-cheeked. Many that have been free to walk the hills and the bogs and the rushes will be sent to walk hard streets in far countries. Many a good plan will be broken. Many that have garnered money will not stay to spend it. Many a child will be born and there will be no father at its christening to give it a name. They that have red cheeks will have pale cheeks for my sake, and for all that they will think they are well paid." When Maud appeared in Kathleen O'Houlihan, apparently she declaimed this climactic speech to the audience. She didn't actually say it to the cast, which caused Stephen Gwynne, the journalist, to ask himself, famously, if such plays should be produced unless one was prepared for people to go out to shoot and be shot. Maud didn't shoot herself, but she certainly did her bit to send people out to do it. Maud had limelight at a time when Constance Markowitz was extremely bored. She had a daughter in 1901, but that didn't keep her interested for long. She sent her off to stay with her mother in Sligo, retrieved her for a while. But the pace of social life in Dublin was too much. She was setting up the arts club. She was being a bohemian. And she had a lot of servants, but really she didn't have time for Maeve. So Maeve was sent to Sligo permanently at 7. Constance used to visit her once a year. And Maeve is recorded as saying after Mummy came home for a few days and they had great fun romping in the fields, she said, "That's it, she won't think of me for another year." Maud Gonne, of course, who was always a reliable eejit, wrote of this, Constance loved children, and it was a great sacrifice when she sent Maeve to be brought up by her mother, because life's evolution had made things too strenuous for the child at home. I have heard people criticise Con for this and speak of her as a neglectful mother. Nothing could be falser than that. But she was so unselfish, she sacrificed everything for Ireland. To the extent that when Maeve came to meet her, when Maeve was 20, she didn't actually recognise her. In 1905, Constance writes in her diary, "What do I want? I don't know. I feel the want." Women are made to adore and sacrifice themselves, and I, as a woman, demand as a right. She was ahead of herself, wasn't she? I, as a woman, demand as a right that nature should provide me with something to live for, something to die for. Maeve wasn't around, and Casimir obviously wasn't up to snuff. And the Dublin arty circles were getting dull. And the castle, of course, where she spent quite a lot of time being in the inner circle. She was already a keen suffragette, and then she found another cause in 1908 when she arrived at Maud Gonne's In Ní Ní Na Héireann. As David Norris pointed out yesterday, it really is pretty rich of Maud Gonne, who hadn't got one drop of Irish blood in her veins, to set up a society called In Ní Ní Na Héireann. She arrived at Maud Gonne's In Ní Ní Na Héireann one night after a castle function. She was wearing a train velvet cloak and diamonds in her hair, hoping not to be noticed. She was soon the gardening correspondent for their journal, Ban na Héireann. "It is a very unpleasant work killing slugs and snails," she wrote, "but let us not be daunted. A good nationalist should look upon slugs in the garden in much the same way as she looks on the English in Ireland, and only regret that she cannot crush the nation's enemies with the same ease that she can the gardens, with just one tread of her fairy foot." Constance stayed keen on women's suffrage and violent protests, but there weren't any uniforms. The woman that Casimir had come to call my floating landmine founded Fianna Éireann, a Republican youth movement which was to carry out Maud Gonne's proposal that young people be trained to fight for Ireland. So Constance, in a very fetching uniform, taught boys to drill, march, scout, shoot, whistle rebel tunes at police, push soldiers into the gutter, and learn that giving one's life for Ireland was the noblest option. It was all great fun, and the opportunity for many, many speeches in that shrill but compelling voice. And then there was socialism. It was really James Larkin. She felt big time for James Larkin. "He was," she wrote, "a titan who might have been moulded by Michelangelo or Rodin. Listening to him, I realised that I was in the presence of something that I had never come across before, some great primeval force, rather than a man, a tornado." So she became the Red Countess, never happier than when dispensing soup from the soup kitchens to which Larkin had consigned the working classes in 1913. And then there was James Connolly. Larkin disappeared, but then there was Connolly. That was a bigger passion. Shona Casey talks about Constance Markovitz as a spluttering Catherine wheel of irresponsibility. She pounced on Connolly and dazzled his eyes with her flashy enthusiasm. She became part of the Citizen Army. Another uniform. Trousers, you've all seen the picture of Constance in one or another of her uniforms. There's a very good posed studio fetching portrait of her with a hat with cockade of feathers and her revolver. Carefully posed before 1916, less there mightn't be any fetching pictures taken from the actual revolution. "She looked lovely in uniform," said one member of the Citizen Army. "My God, she was it." She merged In Ní Ní Na Héireann with Cumann na mBan, which was a militant women's Republican organisation supporting Irish volunteers. And indeed, she would in time address the Dáil in her Cumann na mBan uniform. She was always in favour of armed rebellion. In 1911, her Fianna column in the separatist paper Irish Freedom told its young readers that the history of the world proves that there is but one road to freedom, and that is the red road to war. Freedom attained by oratory, logic, or votes was merely a more secure form of slavery. During the war, shrill, bloodthirsty, and silly, she wanted the war to go on until the British Empire was smashed, regardless of how many more millions died. She added, "The Germans are winning the war, me boys," to the Citizen Army's repertoire. Then there was her performance in 1916. Great opportunities to show off in Stephen's Green, where she liked to give the impression she was in charge rather than second in command to Michael Mallon. She marched up and down, gun on shoulder, in this wonderful uniform, in full view of the Shelburne Hotel, causing a sensation among the guests and the arriving British troops. Did she shoot unarmed Constable Lahief dead and Stevens Green and scream, "I shot him, I shot him"? We don't know. There's conflicting evidence, but it was certainly in character. Shauna Fueloan recalls, "Watching from the shelter of the Green, she saw a khaki uniform in the window of the university club. It was actually an Irishman, Dr. de Burgh Daly, watching the movements below him from the window of the reading room. The page boy from the lower floor was also watching and saw the woman raise her rifle and fire. She missed." So there was a lot of conspicuous and ostentatious shooting of snipers. And there were manifold threats to murder Owen McNeill for having tried to stop a revolution he thought was immoral. She had a whale of a time. She even had an epiphany in the College of Surgeons when she saw Catholics praying and decided she must convert. When she surrendered, she briefly lost her composure. "We dreamed of an Irish Republic and thought we had a fighting chance. Then she broke down and sobbed, kissing her pistol before handing it over." I don't do psychobabble, so I'm not going to talk about phallic symbols. Her court-martial was theatrical. The court president, Brigadier General Blackadder, was so frightened of her that he got out his revolver and put it on the table in front of him. In the formal record of the trial, she is said to have stated, "I went out to fight for Ireland, and it doesn't matter what happens to me. I did what I thought was right, and I stand by it." Establishment Dublin was full of rumours about what was happening in the courts martial. General Blackadder was a great leaker. He leaked the fact that he thought that Patrick Pearse was one of the noblest people he ever met. But he also reported that Constance Markovitz broke down, cried and sobbed, and begged for pity. A diarist of the time reports that Blackadder said it was a terrible scene, the gaunt wreck of a once lovely lady. The prosecutor at her court-martial, William Wiley, wrote a private memoir for his daughter more than 30 years later. "I am only a woman. You cannot shoot a woman. You must not shoot a woman. She never stopped moaning the whole time she was in the courtroom. We were all slightly disgusted. She had been preaching rebellion to a lot of silly boys, death and glory, die for your country, etc., and yet she was literally crawling. I won't say any more. It revolts me still." Yet her account of her time in jail is saying to her jailers, "I wish you had the decency to shoot me." Her death sentence was commuted solely and only on account of her sex. Later in prison, she took instruction in Roman Catholicism, and the priest reported to Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, "I can't understand Countess Markovitz at all. She wants to be received into the church, but she won't attend to me when I try to explain transubstantiation and other doctrines. She just says, 'Please don't trouble to explain. I tell you, I believe all the church teaches.'" When she was in jail with Kathleen Clark and Maud, Kathleen Clark got extremely irritated with Constance. "Again and again, she said to me, 'Why on earth did they arrest such a quiet, insignificant person as you are?' I told her the only information I could give her was what was on my charge sheet, which was exactly the same as hers. She kept on referring to it constantly, until one day, my patience being exhausted, I said that she seemed to forget that when important people like her were in prison, somebody had to carry on, even insignificant nobodies like myself. And that anyhow, I was not here as a result of going on platforms and making speeches asking to be arrested." When news came that Markovitz had been elected to Parliament, Kathleen Clark records, "I was delighted to hear it. At last, I thought, women are going to get recognition. Madame got so excited she went yelling and dancing all over the place. Before leaving us, the governor said, 'And what about little Mrs. Clark?' He made the remark to me, but Madame heard it. She rushed over and flung her arms around me and said, 'Never mind, Kathleen, I'll see you get elected when I get out.' Her air of patronage made me feel like hitting her. But with the governor and the matron present, I had to control my rage." Well, Constance had a good time as Minister for Labour, making lots of speeches about why the police should be ostracised. Did a bit of killing during the Anglo-Irish War, a little bit of killing in the Civil War too, she would do. The Director of British Intelligence, Sir Ormond Winter, who was running British Intelligence from 1920 to 1922, described her as hard, unrepentant, but loquacious, and proudly claiming to have killed 8 British soldiers and hoping she would be the reason for the death of many more. She didn't have a great knowledge of the world. Her stepson Stanislas, whom she had found surplus to requirements during the war and sent off to the Ukraine, had spent 5 years in the Imperial Marine Guard in Russia and then held hostage by Bolsheviks for 2 years. She wrote him a loving letter in 1923. You know, I've had a pretty stiff time of it, and some of it was awful. I did what I could to help you, and I think that some of the people whom I got to intercede for you may have been a little help. Jim Larkin promised to try and get certain Bolshe friends of his to try to set you free. You rail against the Bolshes. I know little about them, but one thing I do know is that our people suffered far worse from the English. I think one of her finest or foulest hours was in the Doyle debates about the treaty. There were 6 women deputies, mostly there because of their relationship to the dead. Kathleen Clark was there because of her husband and brother. Margaret Pierce was there because of her sons. Kate O'Callaghan's husband had been shot by the Black and Tans. Mary McSweeney's brother Terence died in hunger strike. The exceptions were a doctor called Ada English and Constance Markowitz, all of them against the treaty, all of them completely hardline. And I reread the Doyle debates the other week, and I have to say somebody should do a sitcom about them. They are hilarious. I mean, here's poor old Margaret Pierce, who was not the brightest. It has been said here on several occasions that Porrick Pierce would have accepted this treaty. I deny it. As his mother, I deny it, and on his account, I will not accept it. Neither would his brother Willie accept it, because his brother was part and parcel of him. Kathleen Clark. I heard big, strong military men say here they would vote for this treaty, which necessarily means taking an oath of allegiance, and I tell those men there is not power enough to force me, nor eloquence enough to influence me in the whole British Empire into taking that oath, though I am only a frail scrap of humanity. And then she quotes her husband, saying, tell the Irish people that I and my comrades believe we have saved the soul of Ireland. We believe she will never lie down again until she has gained absolute freedom. And the incomparable Mary McSweeney. We have heard a great deal about war tonight and the horrors of war. You men that talk need not talk to us about war. It is the women who suffer. It is the women who suffer the most of the hardships that war brings. This is the woman who encouraged her own brother to die over 74 agonizing days on hunger strike. She suffered the most. You can go out in the excitement of the fight, and it brings its own honor and its own glory. We have to sit at home and work in more humble ways. We have to endure the agony, the sunshines, the torture of misery, and the privations which war brings. It was a theme that some of the other women picked up. It became a given, and the men were afraid to quarrel with it. The men actually were not prepared to say, excuse me, but actually men have a pretty rough time too. It became the given, accepted thing that women had a worse time. In one of her ramblings, I have to, in the spirit of bad taste, describe Mary McSweeney's speeches as the vagina monologues without the sex. This is a moment when it is being suggested that it is up to the people to decide on the treaty, and she is very firmly against that. The Doyle must decide, because the people are not yet trained out of the slavery which the last 100 years have put into their souls. You're betraying them, she was saying, if you don't take the decision for them, because the people are not able to judge for themselves properly, like free men, because of their slavery. I ask you in the name of our martyred dead to take this risk and take the decision for our people. Do a brave thing, a noble thing. If we women who suffer most are willing to take the risk, why should you men not do it? The men were getting a touch restive, and they did actually revolt at one of her better passages. I know that England can win, but she cannot win this battle, for if she exterminates the men, the women will take their places. And if she exterminates the women, the children are rising fast. And if she exterminates the men, women, and children of this generation, the blades of grass, dyed with their blood, will rise, like the dragon's teeth of old, into armed men, and the fight will begin in the next generation. This caused a very brave man called Alec McCabe to say she would not leave us even a grasshopper. And he went on to say that it is nothing less than a criminal incitement to national suicide. Constance came in on this one. She said, defending Mary McSweeney against the charge of having hogged so much time that nobody else had a chance to speak, she said, I would be very glad indeed, said Constance, if they put forward, on the other side, such a person as Miss McSweeney, who gave such an eloquent and well-reasoned speech. Constance then came in to do her bit. It was a bit about women suffering more than most, but what was really exercising her was that Southern Unionists had been approached so that some accommodation could be made with them. Now, why are these men to be given something special? And what do the Southern Unionists stand for? You will all allow they stand for two things. First and foremost, as the people who, in Southern Ireland, have been the English garrison against Ireland and the rights of Ireland. But in Ireland, they stand for something bigger still and worse, something more malignant, for that class of capitalists who have been more crushing, cruel and grinding on the people of the nation than any class of capitalists of whom I ever read in any other country while the people were dying on the roadsides. So we knew her. She stood. She had almost the last exchange at the end of those Dáil debates. It's the stage when Dev leads his people out of the Dáil and Michael Collins loses it and shouts, deserters all. We will now call on the Irish people to rally to us, deserters all. Deserters to the Irish nation in our hour of trial. Madam Markovitz, oath breakers and cowards. Michael Collins, foreigners, Americans, English. Markovitz, Lloyd Georgeites. That's her last appearance. So that was the role model we had. I think it is no surprise that men did everything to keep women out of politics after that. Can you blame them? What a crew. They turned off men for absolutely generations. And we're very lucky that in due course some women came along who showed that they could be ordinary politicians like anybody else and they didn't have to be mad. But Markovitz became the role model. I mean, it was a bit our snobbery. It was a bit the wonderful pose photograph. There was something exotic about her. She's got a GAA park named after her. Leisure centres, swimming pools, statues. She was a snob, a fraud, an exhibitionist, a murderer. She neglected her own child but trained other people's children to kill and die for Ireland. She was certainly a beauty, but boy, was she terrible.
Ruth Dudley Edwards on Constance Markievicz. Next week, Rosemary Cullen-Owens speaks ill of a man who would not have been the Countess's favourite person, Cumann na Gael Minister Kevin O'Higgins.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/Radio 1.